Today is November 23rd, and we're in Metrosen with Ernest Clark.
Thanks for meeting with me again.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Wanted to ask you again a little bit more about your basic training and what that experience was like, leaving the reserve and ending up in Camp Borden.
It was quite traumatic because I wasn't that old and had not gone too far. When you're on their born on the reserve, and you don't travel too far. And in those days, people, families didn't have. You had a tractor, but you didn't have a car, and so we didn't travel too far. And so our world was very small, other than going across into Washington to go to the longhouse, because we were banned in Canada, so we had to go. But there was always somebody to with vehicles to pick you up and take you there.
So you traveled mostly from reserve to reserve when you were younger?
Yes, quite a bit. And with the berry picking and hop picking and apple picking and potatoes and a lot of that, plus your farm chores at home. So our life was, our world was very small, and it was quite a big thing, different to start with by being in the cadets at school, which was mandatory. We had to belong to the cadets, and it was just something you had to do during wartime, Second World War, which was grade 7, 8, and 9. We had 3 years, which was hard discipline and, parading every day at school. It was part of the War Act, possibly, and then to go into the militia, and then the traveling we did and the discipline, and it was, no sleeping in like you do when you're at home. But I was always been an early riser. Quite often, even now, I'm up at 3 o'clock in the morning, sitting here on the couch having a hot milk and Ovaltine, because as you know, I'm involved in quite a few things business wise, and I take 2 sleeping pills, but I still don't sleep because my mind doesn't shut down. Always planning what I'm doing the next day, and ongoing meetings, because as you know, with the casino, it's taken me a few years to get where I'm at now, and we're hopefully a few months away within the next couple of months, and it's going to be a reality. And my sons don't even know, and my wife doesn't really know, what an impact it's gonna be. And
just like you didn't know what the impact was gonna be going to Camp Borden.
No, it's just it's a whole new world, and when your world is very, very small, and you don't travel that far. I mean, I don't remember when I was young, even it was 50 miles to Vancouver, exactly 50 miles, I think, from City Hall to our reserve, and I never went to Vancouver. And so it's quite a trip.
What was your farm like at home?
Well, it was just part of the reserve, and probably about 50 dairy cows. And
Big house?
Yeah, it was quite a good sized house. And the big barn, and chickens and pigs, and horses were a part of our life too. We always had horses. And lots of milk, lots to eat. Never a shortage of food, but usually, couple of pairs of pants and 1 pair of shoes, and I was fortunate that my brothers were older than me, so there was when they were working, logging, there was always lots of hand-me-down clothes. They come out of camp, they all always bought new clothes. So we all wore the same size shoes, my father, myself, and my brothers. So there was whoever got up first got the best pair of shoes.
So what was it like in Camp Borden for you when you got there, or basic training?
Well, I did a lot of basic training in Abbotsford at the airport, which it was good. It was very, you know, really good for discipline, but when you come from a big family, it is like the military. It's very disciplined. You're up at a certain time, and my job was to light the one fire, because we had a wood stove in the living room for heat and a wood stove in the kitchen, and my father always lit the one in the kitchen, and I always lit the one in the living room. And so our life was disciplined at home, and everybody got up and ate breakfast together and then off to school type of thing. So it's more like the military too. And, you know, when you in camp, you have to be out of bed at a certain time. That's why we had a sergeant in our barracks. When it was time to get up, he'd turn the lights on and blow the whistle. And it was inspection. So you're out of bed and dressed, and your blanket's all folded, and that was just part of your life. And then you went and had breakfast, and then lined up on the parade square.
What was your sergeant like?
Like most of them, he's pretty gruff.
Had this one served overseas?
He had just come back, and he's the one that was having a lot of nightmares to do with the war, like a lot of people do, and even though there was no ammunition allowed in the barracks, he had a few clips, and the one night, in the middle of the night, and he woke up from bad dreams, or he was in his bad dreams, and he came right out in the barracks and emptied a couple of clips into the roof while we were woke up from a sound sleep and flattened on the floor. And
how did he deal with it? How was it resolved?
Well, he was taken away. That was the last we saw of him, because he was taken and taken to the lockup for treatment, because it's, you know, you get a lot of bad dreams, like a lot of people get from the residential schools. It's just why most people don't talk about the war. And I was never asked about what we did in training, because my dad was the last one who had asked, because he was First World War. And the uncles never talked about it. They never even said where they were at. You know, and we know where they were. You know, they had been to Holland and all over Europe. But they were just fortunate that they came back, same as my dad. And I mean, he was scared to really contact his family, because his brothers went overseas. And that's why there was such a gap before he really put a trace on his family and found out that the two brothers were still living. And while he was away in those 52 years or whatever, that there was three more brothers and sisters born. So it's a different world now, where people are more open. And you know, our people are very, very closed. And we do have a code of silence within most Aboriginal communities. And I proved it right here in Victoria, because the RCMP are outside the code of silence. And they didn't realize how far outside the code of silence they really were, because I've liaisoned with the RCMP with on different things, because I'm within that code of silence, and it's something that we just keep to ourselves, and a lot of things you don't talk about.
You said you might have even forged your father's signature on your enlistment papers.
Yes, yes.
You wouldn't even go that far to talk to him as to ask him to sign.
No, I know he wouldn't. He probably would have said no. I had to get, we had to get written permission to go to go out of the province. And I signed his signature.
Why do you think he would have said no?
Well, I made up my mind I was going. I already had my traveling papers and a big stack of meal tickets, which they gave us enough for, enough to last us probably for 6 months, just to go on, you know, 4 days and four nights on the train. So we had lots of food. But it was quite an experience. My first train ride.
How was that?
It was very enjoyable. I mean, the train we were on, it was one of the ones that stopped at every whistle stop, milk stop. And but it was good to see. I wished I could have gone across the Rockies, like during the daytime. We left Vancouver at night and got into Barrie, Ontario, in the middle of the night. So we didn't. It's like you see on the old war movies. They're on, they're traveling at night and unloading during the night. We didn't even know from where we got off the train what direction we were going to go or how big the camp was when we got there. The first night we got there, they didn't know where to put us, so they put us in the in with the medical corps because we were a different group.
Who did you travel with? Who was in your group? Were they mostly from Chilliwack or from that area?
No, from Abbotsford area.
From Abbotsford?
Abbotsford, Sumas, yeah. Just.
Had you gone to school with them?
Yes, yes. Most of it gone, to, you know, through the cadets together and then into the militia.
And you were saying you were the only Aboriginal?
The only First Nations, yes. There was probably, there was two Métis in the group, but you couldn't tell by looking at them. I mean, I didn't know for years, and a couple of years ago, and I was down at the Parliament buildings, and one of the fellows that had gone to Camp Borden with, he was over here for the ceremony at the, when we were honored by the Premier at the Parliament buildings, that one certificate I showed you. And it's, Folds was his last name, and he was at the ceremony in his uniform. And you know, you don't realize, you don't ask people, or nobody would ever admit that they were First Nations. I don't know. It's just a something that, like when I graduated from UVic, when the picture I showed you that was in the paper, and different ones had come up to me and said, I didn't know that you were Native. I mean, whose business is it? Of, you know, what you are, or who you are, or where you come from. I mean, we've had enough. Enough problems growing up with prejudice without openly looking for it. So.
So you felt that growing up then?
Prejudice? Oh yes, definitely. A lot of minorities get, you know, get picked on. It's because in, you know, in school, in the lower grades or our high school, that our group was multinationalities, and we all stuck together as a group. And God help anybody that picked on anybody.
So all those that were distinguishable kind of stuck together.
Yeah, yes, definitely. But we didn't, you know, it's like we're getting out of that now, because it's last, you probably know, as you were growing up, there was a lot of prejudice. But we went through that, and now it's going back the other way again. Life goes in cycles, and you hit a lot of hard times and a lot of the prejudice and like in my family, say, well, of us kids, you just couldn't afford to get an education, and now a lot of the grants that are available are scholarships, and I'd like to see more of that. And
your casino will start one.
Beg your pardon?
Maybe your casino will start one.
Yeah. But what I'd like to see, though, is a lot of pre-apprenticeship program, which the Premier is doing now. They finally announced it, and we've been talking about that for probably 3 or 4 years, because, you know, it's fine to get an education, but you got to follow through on it, and you can get all the education in the world, but if you're not determined to do something with it, it's not going to happen. And I think that money is, a lot of the money is wasted, because there's so many scholarships available, but you've got to be going to the right people.
You were saying as well that even though your father served because he hadn't used his own name, that you guys didn't get any education benefits or anything from that.
No. We didn't know what was available, because you don't know. Like, we could have all got university education, or college, or in that, but we were never told. And
so there's a lot of recruitment campaigns that happen now that are aimed at recruiting Aboriginal youth for the military.
Yes, I think it's a good idea, and I think, you know, as I was growing up, you don't think far enough ahead of for trades or what you're going to do, or pensions. And my age group now, a lot of people that are just getting minimum, and the housing that's out there now, or the rest homes, are for the rich. And I'd never go back, and I go over home for the band meetings, and but we have a rest home in the Stello Nation at Kukulitsa. There is a rest home there, but my roots are now on the island, and right here in Victoria, and but so I basically stay. I chose to live over here, and my sons are over here, and my grandchildren, and so I choose to be over here, because this territory, the coast, is Coast Salish territory, and I'm from Coast Salish, the Fraser Valley, so we, you know.
You had talked about being at the Olympic pole raising with Prince Edward. You had worked on that pole?
Yes, I worked on it for approximately a year, and then I was asked to be in the police uniform after I'd gone through the First Nations Tribal Justice Institute, and I was asked to be there in uniform with Prince Edward and actually two of my cousins are RCMP, and they were at the pole, and they're from RCMP and Duncan, and they're both retired now, but I was right up front beside the pole, because I was Coast Salish, and I was asked by Chief Norman George to be there, which was quite an honor.
Where was it raised?
Ocean Point, right by Ocean Point Resort on the Songhees Reserve.
That must have been quite the experience meeting Prince Edward.
It was, yeah, it was really good.
So you've done a lot of community building.
Yeah.
Working with non-Aboriginal community, veteran community, Aboriginal community, Aboriginal liaison.
I've been involved in a lot of things, and you know, I really enjoy it. It's just the same thing now that I do. As an elder, I get called upon to during the Olympics when they brought the medicine bundle from Hobima, Alberta, for the Olympics, and I was asked to sit in the circle and smoke the peace pipe with the two chiefs that brought the bundle. Norman George asked if I would do the honor them by sitting with them, and I did. And I also presented the chief, because they, for smudging, they didn't have any eagle feathers, so I presented him with an eagle wing, eagle fan, you know, it was a heart wing, the same as IPAC for the veterans ceremonies, because the eagle feather, especially the heart wing, represents all veterans who have gone, not just Aboriginal, but all nationalities, even the enemy. They're all veterans, or they have a you know, a soul. So many things that we do in life, it's just another step in your life, or that we go through, and just we're like, when people say, you know, I always say, you never quit learning. Every day is a new day, and you keep on learning, and you have to pass this on to, like yourself, the younger ones. You've got to pass on the teachings. Because, you know, unless you talk about it, you forget a lot of stuff that you have done and stuff that you were involved in. And I mean, I buy an Aboriginal commercial license, fishing license, every year, and I may go out on one trip. But as you know, with Frank Plains, he's my fishing buddy, and we go out quite a bit, probably a dozen or so times at least. And we go out just to get away from, I go out to get away from telephones. And because you can do a lot of thinking when you're out on the water. And when I was doing counseling, I mean, I didn't counsel in a building. I chose to take some of the ones I counseled down to the ocean, down to the water, if it was nice. Go down there and talk by the waves coming in, and sea life, and you accomplish a lot more and get people to relax. You know, but we don't. See, that's one thing you don't talk about, or you don't say, you know, nobody knows all the different ones that I have counseled in the last 20 years that I've asked to help people. And like the big drum that's in my office there, I mean, I counseled a lady for a couple of years that somebody tried to kill her. And I counseled her, and I said, no. She said, well, I don't have money to pay you. And I said, well, I'm not looking for anything. I said, I want to help you. And so she presented me with the drum. First, she presented me with a Christmas card with a gift certificate in it. And that's serial number 5, that drum. Yes. One fellow that I had counseled, and he'd been drinking quite a bit, and he used to get quite angry, and I was taking him to the AA meetings, and the one meeting, you know, he would never stand up and talk, and I kept encouraging him to talk, but this Christmas time, and the counselor asked if there's anybody else who would like to speak, and he put his hand up, and I figured, oh my God, what's going to happen? And he got up and spoke, and he says, you know, he said even 2 months ago, he said
I hated all you 8 people. And but he said, now, he said, I want to tell you I love you all and want to wish you all a very Merry Christmas. And he sat down. And I figured, oh my God, you know, I'm making progress. I've made progress. And that's what you want to see, is for people to come out of their shell. And that was probably one of my biggest achievements of helping people, was to get this particular person to open up. And he's, to this day, I think he stayed away from alcohol and the bad stuff. So it feels good when you can help people. And hopefully, you know, there's more of the elders will open up to the young people or to people that need help. Because when you're brought up in the longhouse and... like yesterday, I was outside, and I told you I get blockages and get these visions, and I had another one yesterday. And sometimes they come quite frequently when you're always thinking about family, yeah. Ones that I've lost, because a lot of my relations now and the elders from our reserve now, we're losing them all the time. And so I get these visions more and more often. And so I got to start slowing down too. That big magic 7-0 coming up next year. But I don't feel it. I mean, I always thought that age was just a figure of speech. And I don't have time to slow down, because there's still so many things that I want to do. And it's just like going back, you know, getting a university was something that I enjoyed and wanted to do. And all of a sudden, I was the first one to be accepted into the Aboriginal program. When I got up to UVic, there was 2 girls sitting in admitting. And I was the first one accepted. And the one girl said, are you status or do you work for the government? And I said, I'm status. And she said, can I see your status card? And I said, yes. I took my status card out, and she says, can I take it for a minute? And she went in behind one of those portable walls, and this other lady poked her head out, and she came back and gave me back my status card. She said, you just won me a free dinner of my choice at any restaurant. She said, we had a bet on, and he said she was betting it would be somebody from the government.
Accepted into the program?
Yes, yeah. Because we did have some people from the government in the class, but at any meetings in government offices, they weren't allowed to speak. You know, the code of silence. They would have been reprimanded if they did speak. We knew that. It's just all part of politics. They weren't allowed to ask any questions, so I had a few pieces of paper passed to me under the table with questions. Oh, you're very welcome.
Anything else that comes to mind before we wrap up?
No, I don't. I think I probably mentioned to you that I was also involved in car racing. And we spent quite a bit of time in the States. We ran a Grand National race car. I was part owner, so our car spent quite a few months out of the year in the States. All the way between Washington and Daytona Beach, Florida. So we're fortunate that most of us were in business for ourselves, and we could get away and travel. And my sons would have loved to be out on the beach. We were down in the States doing the different. different racetracks all over the Pacific Northwest. We were the first Canadian to ever win the Winston West Grand National.
First Canadian.
And we won it 2 years in a row. So it's just...
You were the driver?
No, I was owner and crew. So we had the same crew for many years and many different drivers. So it was just something that was the way it was an out to get away from... You forget what you're doing business-wise and things. And so it was just another...
Perspective.
Yeah. Another part of your life. You're very welcome.
And interview with Ernie Clark as part of UVic's oral history program, recorded on November 23rd, 2005. This is the second interview with Ernest Clark in Metchosin, BC. End of tape and side one. Thank you.